Letters on Sympathy by Sophia de Grouchy, first published in 1798. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Letter 8, Sympathy and Penal Law.
You have seen, my dear friend, how greatly the interest in being unjust was spread and intensified by faulty institutions, that the latter, far from protecting man against his own weaknesses, often do nothing but take advantage of them, so as to lead him toward corruption, by the means that are the most effective for enticing the small number who benefit from it, and for imposing it on the multitude who suffer from it, and that by hindering man in the exercise of his natural rights for whole centuries, they have led him from mere misfortune to the credulous and idiotic blindness that makes him accept as a law of necessity the chains he can no longer judge or break. It will not be difficult to show how reasonable laws can both add to the personal interest in being just and strengthen the power of conscience, even with respect to matters which it alone must govern and punish. Actions contrary to justice can be divided into two classes: genuine crimes that the law punishes, and unjust actions outside the scope of the law, because they are either unimportant or difficult to prove. In all societies there are laws to punish crimes, and penalties are established that seem at least strong enough to deter crimes, but very often fail to do so, leading to complaints that the penalties are not severe enough. But has any one examined with enough impartiality and attention what some philosophers, all too few of them, have written on this topic in recent years? I shan't be afraid to remind you of it here, because one should repeat important truths, not only to get them adopted by all enlightened men, but also to silence the self-interested defenders of the abuses these truths challenge. What prevents crime is not so much the severity of penalties as their certainty, and when they are extremely severe, they always produce impunity. A humane man does not denounce a servant who has stolen from him, when the servant is subject to the death penalty. And the same humane drive almost always keeps people from reporting minor thefts that would bring a penalty which, though less serious, would still not fit the crime. On the other hand, if for lesser crimes we limited correctional penalties to public opinion, and really let that be the punishment, and if for ordinary offences, as well as for the most heinous ones, we did not abruptly break all the links that tie the guilty person to society, by taking his life or by shaming him with indelible infamy, then out of the common interest everyone would make it a duty to denounce criminals, and would be even less lenient toward them, if need and the degradation to which it leads were not almost always their excuse. Thus the severity of criminal laws and civil laws that favour inequality are the cause of the impunity of lesser crimes, and they can also be seen as the cause of greater crimes, because the impunity of the lesser emboldens people to commit the greater. For fear of punishment to be effective and salutary, the penalty must not be revoltingly severe. The justice of it must be apparent to the most ordinary reason. And above all, it must awaken the conscience while punishing it for being sleepily silent. If the penalties are too strong, so that rather than inspiring horror for the crime, they themselves convey the idea of barbarism or of injustice, if they do not punish the injustices suffered by the poor at the hands of the rich, if, when these injustices are not suitable for legal punishment, the law does not prevent them in some other way, if the judge can, at his own choice, stiffen or soften a penalty, and if there are personal privileges, hereditary or local, that allow someone to legally avoid punishment, or provide indirect but reliable means of doing so, then the people are tempted to regard the criminal laws as having been made against them for the rich, the result of a coalition intended to oppress them, in which case they hate these laws, even more than they fear them,
these laws that no longer sting their conscience because they sicken their reason.
This hate conquers fear in resolute souls, and in all those embittered by the allied sentiments of injustice and need. Laws that favour the inequality of fortunes, in addition to all the drawbacks I have pointed out to you, also multiply the number of people who have nothing to lose. The man with some property not only feels more strongly the justness of respecting the property of others, but also is held back from theft by the fear of losing his own property, by fear of reprisal, and by the necessity of giving back at least the value of what he has stolen. The interest in pursuing him is increased by the victim's hope of restitution, which increases his fear of being exposed to the slightest suspicion, and of having to put up an always unpleasant and expensive defence against accusations. Finally, if the vices of social institutions did not open the door to bad actions that are hard to prove, impossible to get reparations for, and sometimes dangerous even to complain about, there would be fewer men reduced to committing overt theft. If the social order preserved men's natural rights, this would put them in the best position to respect one another's rights, and then these rights would be guaranteed by each individual's interest in his own happiness and tranquillity, even more than by the laws. You see, then, my dear friend, that social institutions are still very far from having derived from penal laws all the good that could come from them, and they cannot do this unless the people can regard those whose business it is to apply the laws, to arrest the guilty, and to condemn them not as their masters but only as their defenders and friends. It is through thoughts like these, about what criminal laws could be, that the philosophers have been led to attack laws that bring more abuses than advantages. Though this critique was wanted by all unbiased men, and justified by all too many injustices, it earned those who undertook it the label of innovators, meant as an insult, but actually a badge of honour. If they called for laws that the guilty cannot escape, and the innocent never have to fear, they called for just laws. If they called for less harsh laws, they did this by demonstrating that the harshness of the laws is as dangerous as it is unjust. If they considered reason and public utility as the natural and unshakable judges of social institutions, it is because they are the only general and infallible rules. So their critics should either stop slandering these philosophers and trying to silence them, or come right out with it and claim that it is dangerous to make use of one's reason. Another approach levelled against these philosophers, one as apparently serious as it is obviously ridiculous, accuses them of wanting to substitute the wheel and the scaffold for the true foundation of morality, and especially for unexplained drives towards being just. Those who are accused of wanting to govern men by these barbaric means are the very ones who sought to soften the laws so as to make them more inescapable and efficacious, the ones who asked for justice and reason to judge what punishments would fit what crimes. If until now cruel laws associated with unexplained drives have not been able to keep men from turning to crime, then the charge of slandering human nature no longer holds against those who have said that gentler and more harmonious laws, uniting their force to that of reason and conscience, could have more power to prevent crime. Are there any countries where a better and more common use of unexplained drives makes it unnecessary to establish a penal code? Does history reveal a people under the sway of these drives who are neither barbaric nor corrupt? Of course not. Then let their defenders content themselves with offering them as great hope, and a sometimes useful and gentle consolation, to the unfortunate individual for whom the sentiments of courage and virtue are not enough. But let them stop boasting that they are elevating human nature at the very moment when they are degrading it by offering it an imaginary and make-believe grandeur, and demeaning what is greatest and noblest in human nature, reason and conscience. Let them also stop accusing conscience of being insufficient, when it is they who make it so, by establishing on the ruins of reason an extrinsic power that can only rule amidst their rubble. Tell me, my dear friend, what drive or interest would lead someone who has nothing to lose to respect another's property? This question is not perplexing when one thinks about it. Start with an established craftsman or farmer who depends on his own labour for his subsistence. He has the greatest reason to respect others' property, either because without this respect he would soon be unemployed, or because he is afraid that others will not respect his property. Even if he has no assured resources for his subsistence, he will have some garments, some animals, some supplies, and some furniture, and the poorer he is, the more he must fear the loss of his last resources. If he is well off, his fear of being robbed must be strong, because of his role as a target of greed. And if he hasn't enough to live on, the strength of this fear must be commensurate with his needs. Besides, the general utility that leads one to respect the property of others is palpable from the moment everyone can hope to own something. And I have shown you that in a well-governed country, nearly everyone will have some little property. Consider the worker who has nothing. If he hopes that in the prime of life he can accumulate enough to support him in his old age, he will lose this precious and necessary hope the moment he stops respecting others' property. Precious and necessary though it is, this hope's power cannot be appreciated unless one follows, through time and with concern, the lives of some of these unfortunate beings, who, forced each day to weigh their strength against their needs, don't imagine any happiness beyond being able to live without work, or at least without anxiety. Furthermore, if theft were limited to what is absolutely necessary to preserve existence at the moment an overriding need threatens it, first, morality would look on this act with forbearance. But even then, theft would be the least and the most dangerous option, because as soon as bad laws stop multiplying needs and accidents, one will always do better by trying to get help through legitimate and peaceable means. Simply eliminate the extreme inequality that puts the poor too far from the rich to be known by them, and to see them or have their hearts touched by the voice of humanity, and unexpected misfortunes will become rarer and will be more securely remedied. Deprive all the petty tyrants of their devastating power, and whisk away the heaps of gold, so that man can no longer be raised so high above man that he stops seeing his duties alongside his interests. Do this, and thievery and fraud will become rare enough for their most fearsome punishments to consist in their being made public. As for unjust actions that are rightly not the object of penal laws, be it noted that in general, everyone has an interest in getting the trust of others, through a reputation for honesty and virtue. We like our tenant farmer to be an upright man, and our servant to be faithful. We prefer the craftsman whose probity is recognized to one whose honesty is suspect. If this drive towards getting confidence is not very strong in today's societies, that is because with the acquisition of many social advantages, general trust doesn't come into it. Because a host of institutions, apparently established for a useful purpose and preserved as prerogatives and sacred possessions, exempt civilized men from virtues that savage men would need if they were to live together in peace. Because, nearly everywhere, the rewards of vanity dislodge the rights of true merit and stifle the sense of merit. Because the multiplicity and obscurity of laws, regulations, etc., prevent us from recognizing where probity exists, or allow people to acquire and preserve a false reputation for probity. Because religious hypocrisy offers yet another almost certain means of maintaining such a reputation. Because all the abuses make it possible for someone to get a reputation for probity by dishonest self-seeking and manipulative skill, without outright lying, and without even hiding anything much. And because men are estranged from one another by the extreme inequality of fortunes, the great distance separating one class from another. For the virtues to be known and communicated, they must somehow be placed at the same economic level. The powerful man and the worker he employs are too far apart to judge each other. And at this social distance, where their duties towards one another seem to disappear, one can oppress the other almost without remorse, and the latter can deceive the former with impunity, and can even believe that he is entitled to do so. The misery of a large group, leading them to be suspicious and grasping and deceptive, makes it all the more impossible for them to insist on honesty in those they buy from or sell to. Thus, in all social relations, a host of wicked institutions isolates man from man, on one side by the abuse of power, on the other by the denial of natural rights, making probity and justice useless and foreign, annihilating nearly all their advantages and the drives towards them. Not only do the errors of social institutions make men almost indifferent to performing the most sacred duties, confining a full force interest in performing them to the few sensitive beings who need the happiness of doing their duty, but they also, by means of the artificial needs they created, weakened one of the most powerful drives towards honest conduct, namely the drive to enjoy domestic peace. Through exaggerated rewards, and by unfair and heady distinctions, they exalted amour-propre to the point of turning it into a dominant passion that could stifle the most powerful as well as the most delicate sentiments. And they derailed, corrupted, and blinded amour-propre by assigning what ought to be the rewards of great deeds and grand virtues to those who were in high positions, or happened to have good births or large fortunes. In all classes and in all passions, social institutions added to the primary and real existence of each individual, an imaginary belief-fed existence whose needs were more numerous, insatiable, and fickle, and whose pleasures were inevitably followed by disgust. A man shaped by these institutions was no longer happy or unhappy in himself, because his faculties were well or badly used, or because he possessed or lacked things his faculties pointed to. He no longer judged, acted, and enjoyed on the basis of his own thoughts and feelings. Hemmed in on nearly all sides by unjust laws, he was blessed by fortune, or enticed towards it, by the abuses spawned by these laws, was blinded and softened by his interests, that were nearly always opposed to the voices of reason and humanity, and was able to satisfy his most audacious claims without having to justify them by true merit, and to satisfy his most corrupt passions without universal contempt recalling him to remorse. As soon as he had enough to live on, he was placed in the circle of vanity, a plaything of the innumerable prejudices with which it entangled his steps. The opinions of others became the voice of his conscience, the always necessary justification of his pleasures, and the first requirement for his happiness. This picture will doubtless seem exaggerated to you, my dear friend, but I can explain why that might be so without backing down. Automatically and effortlessly devoted as you are to your works and your affections, your habitual sense of reason and virtue has perhaps put you too far from most men to perceive all their errors, or at least the error's deep roots. Yet who in society will not find in an honest self-examination that he bears within himself society's principal traits? What man of the world is not still led by the indirect but real effect of our institutions to sacrifice what his true happiness requires in his choice of home life, in the use of his time or his fortune, in his pleasures, his tastes, and even his affections, giving it all up because of vanity? Where is he who, faithful to reason and nature, prefers the true pleasures of peace and domestic virtues to the seductive pleasures of amour propre, the habit of which makes one lose the need for the others, and indeed for any taste or sense of them? Where is he who never allows himself to be carried away by the devices that idleness and corruption have contrived to relieve man from the burdensome awareness of his own existence? An awareness that soon becomes unpleasant,
unless the charm of virtue comes to mix with the consuming charm of the passions and the dry pleasures of the mind. Where is he who always reserves a part of his soul for self-reflection, and for enjoying nature's sentiments with the ease and self-consciousness that is the source of all their delight and all their power? Where is the man who, when surrounded by institutions, prejudices, and customs, whose effect was to tightly bind sensibility to amour propre, would need simple private pleasure to find around his own hearth the security of mutual esteem and the exquisite peace of reciprocal understanding, goodwill, and boundless indulgence, still feeling some attraction for those gentle sentiments that passion and vanity look on with contempt, but can be described as the warp and weft of happiness, the only fabric that time does not wear out or cast away? Where is he who, instead of always seeking far from nature some new way of enjoying or abusing his blessings, each day discovers in his immediate surroundings a new pleasure in transforming all the constraints of duty and servitude into relations of beneficence, good faith, and goodness, thereby making his household an asylum, where the happiness that he is owed forces him to delight in his own existence? Oh, you intimate and consoling enjoyments, attached to peace and private virtues! True and touching pleasures that never leave a heart once you have melted it! You from which we are ceaselessly alienated by the tyrannical power of vanity, whose seductive magic allows us to perceive ourselves only under the dark colours of duty, discontent, and monotony. Woe unto anyone who disdains and abandons you! Woe above all to the sex who are briefly loaded with resplendent gifts from nature, which for so long afterwards is a cruel stepmother, if they neglect you or don't know you. For it is with you that they must spend half their lives forgetting, if possible, the enchanted cup that the hand of time overturns for them in midlife. End of letter 8. End of work.